Good evening and welcome, everybody. My name is Yaakov Yadgar, and I am especially delighted to be opening this book launch event. It's always a delight to present to the Oxford community works that deal with topics we are dealing with that have been written here and have been produced here and are part of the intellectual community that is Oxford and Middle East Studies at Oxford. And obviously, we're all here today to celebrate the launching of the book by Peter Bergamin. And I'll say just a few words on Peter, and he'll present the book, so then I don't need to present the work itself. Peter completed his DPhil in Oriental Studies here at Oxford in 2016 under the supervision of Derek Pensler. Some of you may know my predecessor. His thesis traced the ideological development of the pro-fascist revisionist Zionist ideologue Abba Achimir, and obviously the book being presented this evening is a monograph based on this thesis. Peter's research focuses on maximalist revisionist Zionism and Jewish anti-British resistance during the period of the mandate, the British mandate in Palestine. He is currently finishing a monograph for a new project that examines Britain's decision, in 1947 to appeal to the United Nations to be released from the mandate. And in the future, he hopes to combine his previous experience as a musician with his current research interest in projects that will examine the effects of anti-Semitism on Gustav Mahler's directorship of the Vienna Court Opera and anti-Semitic characterizations in the operas of Richard Wagner. In addition, he is a visiting scholar at the Oxford Center for Hebrew and Jewish Studies and lecturer in Oriental Studies at Mansfield College, and he's a dear friend and member of the many communities we are part of. Peter, welcome. Thank you, sir.
Cheers. Thank you. Thank you all very much indeed for coming out this afternoon. And I mean, I see people here from the OI, the Clarendon Institute, the History Faculty, the OJC, and certainly Mansfield College. You're all represented here rather robustly, so I really can't thank you enough. I could really easily fill the next 45 minutes or so naming, not shaming, but thanking all of you, all those of you here who really lent me your very considerable help, expertise, time, etc., during the course of my doctoral studies, but I think I should probably say something about the book. Yaakov, in particular, I'd like to thank you for facilitating very easily and very kind of effortlessly, for me at least, the organization of this evening, and to Eugene for agreeing to host it here at the Middle East Center, which is rather fitting, as we've just discussed, not only because of the book's subject matter, but also because, in fact, Eugene was the first person ever to refer to me as Dr. Bergamin, albeit in a rejection email, but thanks a lot. The talk will be in, I think, four parts. I haven't really added to math, is not my skill. But I'm going to give you a little, very little biographical introduction to the figure of Abba Achimeir, then some background into the genesis of this study, a few of the thematic and research highlights of the book, and finally I'll read from the book's conclusion. So it's about 20 minutes and 20 minutes, if you can time your eggs. Anyway, yes. So Abba Achimeir stood at the vanguard of Zionist anti-British resistance. He referred to the British mandatory government as both perfidious Albion, kind of an old trope, and a foreign occupier in print already in 1929. The following year, 1930, he founded the first anti-British resistance group in the Jewish community in Palestine. It's called the Yeshuv, and I'll refer to it under that name for the next few minutes. And he eventually went to prison in 1934. I think I've got a prison picture of him going to prison somewhere. There, that's not him. There he is, going to prison. For his involvement with this group. Let's go back. There we are. He was born Abba Chaisinovich on the 2nd of November, 1897, a fact that would allow future historians to note that he was born 30 years to the day before the Balfour Declaration was issued. He grew up in Bobruisk in Belarus, where his father was an affluent timber merchant, and he attended a Russian school by day and a Hebrew school in the evening. In 1912, accompanied by his older sister, the 14-year-old youth traveled to Ottoman Palestine to study at the Herzliya Gymnasium, which had opened in 1905 as the first Hebrew high school in the Yeshuv. I mean, think about that, 14 years old in 1912, it wasn't like going to Stansted and getting on EasyJet. I mean, it was a big deal, right? This 14-year-old kid, by his own initiative. So he's pretty committed from the very beginning. He returned to Bobruisk in the summer of 1914 for a school vacation, but obviously the outbreak of the First World War forced him to remain there for an extended sojourn, which turned out to be 10 years. He was thus in Russia for the duration of the war, and perhaps more importantly, the Bolshevik Revolution, which eventually claimed the life of his brother Mer, a trauma from which he never recovered. And indeed, it affected his name change in 1919 from Hysinovich to Achimeir, which means my brother Mer in Hebrew. In 1921, after stints at the University of Kiev and Liège, he began doctoral studies at the University of Vienna and received his doctorate there in 1924, having written on the conception of Russia in Oswald Spengler's Der Untergang des Abendlandes, The Decline of the West, kind of a magnum opus, rather misguided, but kind of cool. He finally returned to what was now British Mandate Palestine in the summer of 1914, and now as Abba Achimeir, began to make a name for himself as a teacher and a journalist. From 1924 to 1928, he was a member of the moderate socialist party Hapoel Hatzair and a regular contributor to the party journal and the newspapers Davar and Haaretz. However, his increasing disillusionment with both the party and socialism in general had become clear to him by May of 1926, and Achimeir, along with his colleagues, the poet Uri Zvi Greenberg and writer Yehoshua Yavin, eventually jumped ship and joined Zev Jabotinsky's revisionist Zionist party in February 1928. Zev Jabotinsky, there he is, formed the revisionist party after he resigned from the Zionist organization executive in 1923 in protest to its acceptance of Britain's creation of Transjordan, which he and his adherents considered to be part of the biblical land of Israel and therefore non-negotiable and integral to any future Jewish state. The revisionists were further dissatisfied with the current policy in Palestine of practical Zionism, let's say in a nutshell, that's settlement before statehood, and instead called for a revision, hence the name of the party, back to the ideology and practice of political Zionism, which was statehood before settlement, as had been preached by its father, whom I'm sure you've all heard of, Theodor Herzl. In the wake of Arab riots, Arab anti-Jewish riots in August 1929, Achimeir and his two colleagues, Greenberg and Yavin, so there they are, established the maximalist arm of the revisionist party in the Yishuv. Kind of a great picture, isn't it? They don't look all that tough. I said to Yaakov before, Yavin on the right kind of looks like the love child between Dustin Hoffman and Mrs. Doubtfire. But anyway, there you go. He said they didn't know how to party. Unlike Jabotinsky and the more mainstream revisionists, the maximalists fought specifically against the British government in Palestine. They rejected Jabotinsky's policy of what he called havlaga, or defensive restraint, when dealing with both Arab and British antagonism, and called instead for active paramilitary resistance to both groups. Finally, in addition to advocating fascism as the ideological modus operandi for the revisionists, and if that wasn't enough, the maximalists rather singularly employed pointed quasi-messianic imagery as a rhetorical device in their articles and speeches. The maximalist revisionism enjoyed a short but intense period of relative popularity. So from 1929 to 1934, it was in fact the dominant stream of revisionist Zionism in the Yishuv, but it was dealt a death blow in the wake of the murder of the labor leader Chaim Lazarov in 1933, for which Achimeir was arrested as having plotted the murder, but later acquitted, and more on that later. So the passage of time and the particular unfolding of world events since 1934 have led to a perhaps undue amount of focus on Achimeir as a fascist. Hang on. So indeed, within a year of him joining Jabotinsky's revisionist party, Jabotinsky himself had referred to his younger colleague as talented but too much a fascist. And this is perhaps the way in which Achimeir is most often remembered to this day, certainly in Israel. He was undoubtedly a controversial figure who espoused at times some highly controversial ideas. So why? Why do I want to write about it? How did this start? I was first introduced to Achimeir during the course of study years ago at SOAS, when Colin Schindler, professor of Israel studies, in his History of Zionism course, posed this essay question. Why were the writings of Abba Achimeir, Uri Zvi Greenberg, just done something to the computer, sorry. And Yonatan Ratosh, who's not pictured here, influential on the young Menachem Begin. I think I'd only heard of Begin, so that's why I chose the question. But while reading up on the trio, especially in Colin's book, The Triumph of Military Zionism, the name Abba Achimeir kept popping up more than the others and seemed to be a little more important. And I thought already at this time that it would be interesting to look more into his figure. His group, Brit HaBiryanim, which has been translated in so many different ways depending on a person's particular political position, but anything from the Covenant of Thugs to the Union of Zionist Rebels to the Praetorian Guard to the defenders of the capital, the Bira, right, had a sort of exotic messianic ring to it, as did such texts as the Scroll of the Zakari, the Megillat HaSikrikin, dedicated no less to the memories of Dora Kaplan and Charlotte Corday, but which had no English translation. So when I wanted to look in further into these works, I found that there was nothing except kind of descriptions about them. So Achamer came across to me, at least, as a romantic in this kind of cynical, nihilistic way, which at this stage in my life, the art was now lost on me. but also perhaps as someone who had originally trained as an orchestra conductor as myself, and stood in front of various ensembles for years, telling them what to do. The irony was also not lost on me that there was a certain transfer of skills when dealing with topics such as dictatorship and fascism. I kind of felt I was a little bit in my element. I continued studying at the Hebrew University for a year with Gidon Shimoni, who quite literally wrote the book on Zionist ideology, a book called The Zionist Ideology. And I did an independent paper with him that looked at the aesthetics and ideology of revisionist Zionism. It was quite influential for me. He's a wonderful, wonderful man. During that same time, and kind of completely coincidentally, I'd been going to a local synagogue where I lived in a place called Nachlaot in Jerusalem. If you've ever been there, it's kind of full of people who did, I think, too much acid in the 60s and became religious, and now flash back to the Second Temple period. But anyway, there's a Reform synagogue called Harel. And I was getting to know the community a little, including the rather dynamic Rabbi Ada Zavidov, who was at the time, and I think still, the only woman to have a congregation in Jerusalem, first woman certainly to have a congregation in Jerusalem, if not the only. And we became really good friends. Sometime in that January or February, I received the quarterly newsletter of the synagogue, and there were pictures of Ada's 50th birthday party that had happened before I started going there, so because it was a quarterly newsletter. And in particular, there was a picture of the well-known Israeli TV news presenter, Yaakov Achamer, who's Achamer's son. And the caption underneath the photo said, Uncle Yaakov bringing birthday greetings from the family. And I thought, hang on. I tried to do the math, but it was not my strong point. So the next time I saw her, I said, Ada, are you related to Abba Achamer? And she said, well, he's my grandfather. And I was like, wow. I explained that I was already working on a paper with Gidon Shimoni about this, and she said to me, well, you must meet my uncle Yossi. So about a week or 2 weeks later, we arranged through email some sort of introduction to Yossi Achamer in Ramat Gan, so Tel Aviv. And I was really terrified. I'm very rarely terrified of things, but I was terrified to meet Yossi Achamer. I mean, he was a prominent journalist. He was an ex-Likud member of Knesset. He was the chief of staff to Yitzhak Shamir, the Extern Gang Prime Minister of Israel in 83, 84, and 86, 92, and he was now director of the Jabotinsky Institute. Quite a formidable figure indeed. So I was pretty terrified going to that first meeting. I remember it was on a Tuesday night in Ramat Gan. It was Tel Aviv, March. It was kind of about 10,000% humidity, and I arrived just kind of not sure where I was or what I was doing. And the archive that he calls the Bet Abba, it means this kind of a play on words there, is in Achamer's house, so the same house that Achamer lived in fact died in, and his study is preserved as on the day he died. He has hats there and his postcards, and it's quite an interesting little museum. After a kind of very awkward hello and would you like a coffee, not me but him, I noticed a CD box set of the 10 Mahler symphonies, and I mentioned to him that I was a musician and Mahler was my favorite composer. And I've got to be honest, we never looked back from that moment. It was quite interesting to me. We hit it off from that very first day. We share a rather robust and certainly very cynical sense of humor. And he's a really genuinely warm and funny person. I mean, he's a really, really wonderful person. We've never, ever discussed politics. And I think that's probably not such a bad idea. It's kind of this unspoken rule with us. He knows where I stand. I know where he stands. And I would say it just goes to show you that true ideological consistency doesn't necessarily exist, right? Really wonderful people can hold some perhaps uncomfortable positions. And I think that's very interesting going to this whole study, which is why I recount it now. While a staunch defender of his father's legacy, which is not surprising since Yossi was 19 when Achamer died suddenly of a heart attack, he always said to me, and I remember this over and over again, you must write what you find. You know, in spite of what I, don't worry about what I think or what I want you to say, but this is what I want you to say, nonetheless, you must write what you find, and I did. Certainly not always an easy position for him to maintain. But his assistance along the whole road of this research has really been invaluable. You know, he let me quite literally into his house where all of this stuff is. And he had hoped to come this evening, but has been prevented due to illness. It's kind of a shame that he's not here. But anyway, it became clear to me that there was a hole in the body of scholarship surrounding Achamayr, and that a rigorous study of his ideological genesis and trajectory would be most useful. With regard to archival material, I thought I'd just touch on that very quickly. The Bet Abba, it's not, I can't even really call it an archive because it's not archived properly. He's not an archivist, he's the kid, you know, he's his son. But he knows where everything is. When he goes, we need really someone to archive this stuff. But it's a treasure trove of published and unpublished essays, articles, and even a book, an unpublished book by Achamayr on the Russian Revolution, and I really only scratched the surface. I first approached Eric Pensler in Toronto, when he was still in Toronto, actually, which is also my hometown, 10, 12 years ago, maybe, about this, and he cautioned me against writing about second-rate philosophers. I remember that discussion at Starbucks at Young and Lawrence. And my reply, of course, as a musician, was like, look at the Puccini operas, or any Italian operas. I mean, the texts are terrible. Doesn't mean they're not influential. Right? And I would say that even Derek agrees today that Achamayr was an important figure, regardless of what he thinks the quality of his work. So what's interesting about this study, let me just maybe get a picture of just Achamayr up here. A little more, I'm not going to jail, perhaps. There we are. Okay, those are his kids, Yossi and Yaakov. It's more or less how they look today. That's not. 70 years later. This is, in fact, the first biography at all in English, and the first academic study dedicated solely to Achamayr, whom no less a historian as Colin Schindler said should share the title, The Father of the Revolt, with Jabotinsky, so not a meaningless compliment. The attraction for me, besides the fact that there was a need for further contribution to the body of scholarship, was that I wouldn't say maybe not a soft spot, but certainly an interest in these kind of unsung heroes, even if I don't necessarily like the tune that they're singing, as it were, right? And I've got to say, having read some of his stuff, I liked his acerbic, cynical writing style. Even if I didn't necessarily agree with it, it was always really interesting to read. More generally, I would say I like to confront difficult history, difficult themes in general, and indeed revise them accordingly if need be. And in a way, I think this book, I like to challenge traditional Israeli historiography, much in the way that, say, Avi does, or, you know, but in a different way. We challenge the same tradition, that this kind of the one that glorifies the labor Zionist Mapai David Ben Gurion myth. Although I try to do this from the opposite end of the mountain, obviously. So I think, and more of that in a minute. Methodological approach. It was pretty easy. There was so much stuff there. I was just trying to figure out how to organize it more than how I was going to do it. I decided fairly early on to try and vary my sources for each chapter just to mix it up a bit. There was no particular reason. Well, there's a little bit of a reason. So the first chapter kind of privileges academic stuff, like his dissertation. The second chapter looks at newspaper articles. The third looks at a kind of broader discussion of a whole bunch of different things. The fourth looks at trading manuals, which I'll talk a little bit about. And the fifth looks at court documents. So just mixed it up a little bit. A very, very brief overview of the book's contents, don't worry. The first chapter really does give a proper concentration on Achamayr's Vienna years, which are completely overlooked, I would say, except kind of in a sentence. He went to Vienna, he did his doctorate on Spengler, and that's it. I managed to stretch that into 50 pages. I'm sorry. but it really looks at his dissertation on Spengler's Decline of the West, which led to some rather interesting conclusions, which I'll talk to you about later. Furthermore, a proper discussion, I would like to think, on the concepts of fascism and revolution and an assessment of Achamayr's embrace of each, allowed me to note that this kind of self-styled fascist really only saw fascism as a modus operandi, as the means to an end, which was a Jewish nation state in Palestine. Furthermore, I thought that Achamayr's embrace of fascism should be understood in its historical context. That's probably a no-brainer when you consider we're writing about somebody between 29 and 34, and not be analyzed with a disproportionate degree of historical hindsight, which doesn't excuse it. But indeed, one of my primary contentions in the book is that we should look at Achamayr not as a fascist who coined the rather innocuous term revolutionary Zionism, but rather as a Zionist revolutionary who saw fascism as the most viable modus operandi for effecting his revolution. I thought the revolutionary side of Achamayr is much more interesting and much more fleshed out from an ideological point of view. He says nothing really about fascism, except that he was one, right? A fascist. I further contend that this revision then allows us to ask two deeper questions, specifically, what was the ideological nature and trajectory of Wachenmeier's concept of revolutionary Zionism? And more generally, did anything resembling a de facto revolution actually occur in the Yishuv on its way to Jewish statehood? And I would maintain that it does. A little bit more about that later. Thirdly, it offers a first real presentation of the workings of the Beitar Leadership Training School. Beitar was the youth group, the revisionist youth group, and the Beitar Leadership Training School was a kind of niche training school for future commanders of Beitar, for potential future commanders to Beitar, because it wasn't 100% affiliated. It was founded in 1930 by someone called Yirmiyahu Halpern, and Wachenmeier taught Jewish history and culture there. And it was really interesting looking at the archival material for this. I found old training manuals from the school and, you know, kind of outlines for meetings, thematic outlines for lectures. I would say it's fascinating cultural historical contribution, if I do say so myself. It's really, really interesting. I think for me that was a really interesting chapter to write. Whoops. It continues the discussion, the book continues the discussion of Wachenmeier's underground resistance group, Brit HaBriyonim, and the group's trial. That Colin Schindler began in his book, The Triumph of Military Zionism. I'm going to try and stop touching the keypad in a minute. Hold on. Maybe I'll just hold these. There we go. And tied to this, wardrobe malfunction. I'm not very good with technology. And tied to this, I think, and more interesting, was a discussion on Chaim Arlosorov that I undertook. And it kind of allowed me to compare his doctoral work, the Yiddish Volkssozialism, the Jewish People's Socialism, which is not a great, it's not as deep a translation as it could be, with Wachenmeier's dissertation, and it allowed me to challenge the traditional labor left historiography by noting much more by way of commonality between Wachenmeier and Arlosorov than many would care to admit, certainly on the left. I think that's enough context. I think I'd like to read you from the conclusion, not the whole conclusion. I figure I'll save you 80 quid or, you know, 50 with the coupon. and I think this was really hard for me to approach. I think so I was like, oh, I don't know, how do you bring it in a conclusion? I mean, I think, you know, and I remember Derek saying to me at the very beginning of the project, I said, you know, what's a really great intellectual biography? The only one I know is kind of Keith Richards' life, right? I said, I can't really do that. And he said, look at Martin Melia's biography on Alexander Herzen. He said, it's almost forgotten today. It was a great book. So I looked at it. I'd looked at it from the beginning of the project, but when I went to write the conclusion, I kind of looked at it again. And I was like, okay, let's see how Melia starts to tie these very loose strands together. And I looked at the opening paragraph. I thought, you know what? I'm just going to lift this and go from there. So I did. And this is what Melia writes. And I thought it was quite interesting. There's kind of a bit of method, not much in my madness. But it says, as of 1855 and the death of Nicholas I, the modern Russian political tradition was scarcely 50 years old. Yet in that relatively short space of time, it had undergone a remarkably swift process of radicalization. The bold will become clear in a minute. In the 30 years of repression under Nicholas, the idea of revolt became the ideal of revolution, and the goal was no longer a change in the political regime or legal status of the citizenry, but a total social and moral renovation of the nation. Indeed, this socialist goal had assumed the form of the most extreme and uncompromising theory of revolutionary liberation, anarchism. And throughout this whole process of radicalization, however, there is one remarkable element of continuity. With each shift leftward, the impetus came predominantly from men of the same social group, the gentry. So that's how I began my conclusion. I don't know if I need these. I'm reading from this. Unfortunately, they didn't print this in maximalist font. So this is how Malia began his conclusion on his biography of Alexander Herzen in a chapter that he called The Gentry Revolutionary. I'm going to actually put this back. And some of the parallels with my own study were rather striking, which is why I lifted it shamelessly. So by 1933, and with the murder of Arlosorov, the modern Jewish political tradition, which is Zionism, was also scarcely 50 years old, and in its somewhat younger Herzlian political ideological form, had also, in a relatively short space of time, undergone a remarkably swift process of radicalization. In the 30 years since Herzl's death, the gradual repression of political Zionist ideology by practical Zionist settlement that was willing to compromise its terms, led to a situation where Jabotinsky's idea of revolt, as embodied in the foundation of revisionist Zionism, became Wachenmeier's ideal of revolution. Of course, in this case, in a movement that was nationalistically political, a change in the political regime or legal status of the citizenry absolutely superseded any social and moral renovation of the nation. Indeed, this nationalist political goal had assumed the form of the most extreme and uncompromising theory of revolutionary nationalist liberation, fascism. And again, as was the case with the modern Russian political tradition, the modern Zionist political tradition was likewise characterized by one remarkable element of continuity. With each shift to the right, the impetus came also predominantly from men of the same social group, in this case, the bourgeois intelligentsia. Why do I use both terms? I'll make that clear in a sec. From Herzl through Nordau to Jabotinsky and Achemeyer, the gradual radicalization of political Zionism was not only led by the bourgeois intelligentsia, but furthermore, one that had, in character and orientation, shifted gradually from Western to Eastern Europe, from more bourgeois to more intelligent, as it were, which is why I use both words. Indeed, the very concepts of intelligentsia and the intelligent are themselves Russian in origin. Moreover, for an Eastern European Jew of Jabotinsky's and Achemeyer's generation, the intelligentsia, whose members had in fact first come from the gentry, had become the gentry of the bourgeoisie, albeit one that was landed with Bildung and was thus a group to which a young Jew could realistically aspire to and attain membership in. The fact that both Jabotinsky and Achemeyer, I've lost my spot, there we are, were cosmopolitan products of both realms, Eastern European by birth and upbringing, Western European by education, only buttresses the argument, I would say. And in this very important respect, both men had followed in the long ideological historical trajectory that had its origins in the Westernization program of Peter the Great, one that saw a selected few, and at this point still members of the gentry, go to Western Europe for a higher education before returning to Russia to assume some sort of civic leadership role. Not only did Achemeyer recognize and place a high value upon Peter the Great as a modernizer, specifically through his Westernization program, as he discusses in his dissertation on Spengler, but Achemeyer himself represented at once the pinnacle and the terminus of its ideological and historical development. In contrast to Achemeyer, Jabotinsky had in 1901, after his studies in Rome, returned to Russia. And he did, in fact, as both a prominent journalist and eventually also Zionist politician, assume a leadership role, albeit one within a smaller Russian, in this case, a Russian Jewish community. So, of course, there is no question of Achemeyer returning to Russia at the end of his education, a fact due not only to his ardent Zionism, but equally as important, to the reality that in post-revolutionary Russia, the anti-Western character of the new communist intelligentsia had now rendered the classic Western-educated Russian intelligent undesirable. Nevertheless, Achemeyer, as both a Russian and a Zionist, certainly upheld the ideals of the traditional Russian intelligentsia, one that has, in the words of the distinguished intellectual historian Isaiah Berlin, founded, broadly speaking, on the idea of a permanent rational opposition to a status quo which was regarded as in constant danger of becoming ossified, a block to human thought and human progress. This is the historic role of the intelligentsia as seen by itself then and now. Sorry. This elitist, and we might even say messianic attitude, informed Achemeyer's role, not only as a member of a traditional Russian intelligentsia, but more important, as a modern political Zionist who stood in permanent opposition to a Jewish national movement that was, through its lack of forward motion, in constant danger of becoming ossified, to quote Berlin again. Indeed, in this latter more pronounced role, Achemeyer embodied Berlin's quintessential real member of the intelligentsia, whom he characterized as, and I quote, the political pamphleteers, the civic-minded poets, the forerunners of the Russian Revolution, mainly journalists and political thinkers who quite consciously use literature, sometimes very poor examples, take note, Puccini, Derek, right, as vehicles for social protest. The only difference in Achemeyer's case was that he no longer looked to Russia but to Zion for his revolution. In the Yeshuv, Achemeyer, now no longer a member, neither geographically, nationalistically, nor ideologically, of a bourgeois Russian intelligentsia, and catalyzed in no small way by what he saw as a truly repressive regime, to quote Berlin again, became instead the leading figure of a new Zionist nationalist intelligentsia militans. Perhaps the simple recognition, that Jabotinsky was living in London during the period of the October Revolution, while Achemeyer experienced it firsthand in Bobruisk, may provide a further telling explanation for both this geographically eastward shift as a key element in the radicalization of the ideology of political Zionism. And the fact that it was Achamer and not, indeed could not be, Jabotinsky who was able to effect it. The year 1917 had for Jabotinsky, with the formation of the Zionist Mule Corps, which was a kind of a mule corps that helped the British out in the fight against the Ottomans, this sowed the seed for Jabotinsky for Jewish military organization. For Achamer, who experienced the Bolshevik Revolution firsthand, 1917 sowed the seeds for Jewish revolutionary organization. One gesture recognized and advocated the utility of European Jewry in the service of modern European politics. The other decried the uselessness of Europe in the service of modern European Jewish politics. Thus, by 1933, Jabotinsky's Zionist bourgeois gentleman had been transformed into Achamer's Zionist bourgeois revolutionary. Jabotinsky's Iron Wall, which refers to an article he wrote in the 1920s, into Achamer's Iron Bridge, another article that Achamer wrote, Kir Barzel versus Gesher Barzel, if you're speaking Hebrew, yet only an ideology. So Jabotinsky and Achamer could both trace their ideological positions back to the Nietzschean concept of Macht, power, as understood and expanded upon by Max Nordau. Nietzsche distinguished between positive authentic and negative inauthentic power. The former was symptomatic of a strong, confident personality. The latter of a weak, insecure, what Nordau called degenerative, right, in his well-known book, Degeneration, personality. Hence, Nordau's concept of Muskeljudentum, or muscular Jewry, in which the negative, degenerative manifestation of power, that he believed prevailed amongst Europe's Jews, by the end of the 19th century, would be transformed into a positive, authentic form. Nonetheless, as the Israeli historian Jacob Golem notes, Jabotinsky in his personality and ideology embodied elements of both positive and negative degenerative manifestations of power. He was equally a child of fin de siècle liberal decadence and a more tempered liberal politics altogether. Achamer, through his radicalization of Jabotinsky in politics and a concept of Macht that saw him solidly embrace fascism or fascist ideology and aesthetic, shifted yet further towards what he believed to be Nietzsche's concept of a positive manifestation of power. The paradox, of course, is that if we accept Nietzsche and Nordau, this fetishization of power, certainly in a fascist sense, represented in reality a far greater insecurity and degeneration than it purported to negate, and it was thus ultimately a shift further towards a Nietzschean negative manifestation of power. The difference between Jabotinsky's and Achamer's degeneration, if you want to put it that way, is that of a bourgeois indulgent versus a bourgeois existential decadence, I would say. So much in the way that Spenglerian philosophy was a more desperately existential manifestation and therefore a necessary consequence of a more indulgently bourgeois Nietzschean philosophy, so was Achamer's embrace of degenerative power a more desperately existential manifestation and therefore a necessary consequence of Jabotinsky's more indulgently bourgeois mixture of Nietzschean positive and negative concepts of Macht. More simply put, and I hear you breathe a sigh of relief, Jabotinsky and indeed Herzl and Nordau after him was decadently illiberal, right? While Achamer and Stern and Begin after him, I would say, were decadently illiberal. Indeed, the fact that it is often so difficult to unequivocally explain Jabotinsky's political position can almost always be attributed to his liberal leanings. We have no such difficulty with Achamer. In this respect, Jabotinsky was still more a child of a Western European and Achamer of an Eastern European bourgeois intelligentsia. This argument is buttressed by Herzen's contention that, and I quote, the bourgeoisie does not have a great past and has no future. It was good only for a moment as a negation, as a transition. So we should assume that Herzen was speaking of a Russian bourgeois intelligentsia, and to a certain degree, Achamer must also have understood his own Russian bourgeois intelligent roots in such a manner, if perhaps only subconsciously so. Indeed, Achamer fits Martin Melia's definition of the Russian intelligent to a T, and Melia defined him as such, as any able, sensitive, and ambitious individual from a more or less privileged group who lives under an inflexible and closed old regime, which does not offer adequate scope for his energies and who consequently goes over to integral as well as highly ideological opposition to that regime. In Achamer's case, the inflexible and closed old regime was less the British mandatory government than it was the Zionist leadership of the Yishuv. Such an analysis would explain Achamer's permanent sense of what might be called desperate transience, and which, be it as a rootless Jew, a stateless Zionist, or an anachronistic Russian bourgeois intellectual, led to his frustrated cynicism and eventual emergence as a bourgeois terrorist, I would say, the spiritual leader and ideologue of the new Zionist intelligentsia militants. Bourgeois terrorist is, I think, Adorno's term. He uses it in search of Wagner. It's a great term. That's actually a profession. But on 1st of February 1944, a few years later, Menachem Begin, who that previous December had taken over the commandership of the Irgun, the revisionist underground paramilitary group, proclaimed a revolt against the British mandatory government in Palestine. With his proclamation, the long trajectory of revolutionary Zionist ideology, can't even say it anymore, that Achmeir had first broached in November 1927, now matured into practical application. Both the Irgun and the Stern Gang, notorious underground anti-British groups, had already carried out various attacks, mainly against Arabs and British policemen over the past 6 years, attacks that had only increased in the wake of the British government's 1939 white paper. This latter highly contentious document, certainly for the Zionists, issued with the aim to end 3 years of Arab revolt in the Yishuv, limited Jewish immigration to Palestine to 75,000 people over the next 5 years, after which no more Jews would be allowed into Palestine without Arab agreement. In a rare moment of unity, all of the various political factions in the Yishuv condemned the paper outright, although they put their feelings on hold for the duration, for the majority of the war. But by 1944, Begin had lost patience. His lengthy declaration of revolt, which was posted throughout the Yishuv on the 1st of February 1944, addressed not the British administration, but the Hebrew nation in Zion, and I quote, directly, and I'm just going to give you a little quote. It says, "Jews, our fighting youth will not be deterred by victims, blood, and suffering. They will not surrender, will not rest until they restore our past glory, until they ensure our people of a homeland, freedom, honor, bread, justice, and law. And if you help them, then your own eyes will soon behold the return to Zion and the rebirth of Israel. May God be with us and aid us." It's much longer than that, but that was kind of enough. In its imagery and tone, biblical, messianic, proud, unapologetic, and indeed unforgiving, the proclamation evoked a Brit Abiryanim pamphlet from April 1932. Brit Abiryanim, again, was Achmer's underground group. The pamphlet from 1932 says, and it's, again, just a few sentences, "At these moments of hatred, throw away modern doctrines and remember those of the ancient legislator, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, and you shall then be safe in your life, honor, property, and land." The revolution that Achmer had foreseen 17 years earlier now began in earnest, although he himself would not play a leading role in its execution. Nonetheless, Achmer considered this both the Stern Gang and the Irgun to be the ideological successors of his group, Brit Abiryanim. The group's most well-known leaders, Avraham Stern and Menachem Begin respectively, were themselves certainly influenced by both Achmer the ideologue and person, although those relationships could at times be strained. Menachem Begin, for his part, completely whitewashes Achmer out of his two biographical accounts. And although the two men remained friends until Achmer's death, Begin kept him at bay politically. For Begin, the politician, it was doubtless seen as bad public relations to be associated with a man who had once represented such a controversial figure as Achmer, Begin's own controversial past notwithstanding. Nonetheless, Begin aligned himself spiritually with Achmer and Brit Abiryanim already in 1933 when he joined the Beitar head command in Warsaw. As Colin Schindler has also noted, clearly Begin, and not just Begin, I suppose, had a psychological need to remember and reshape the past. Nonetheless, it is clear that Begin was influenced by Achmer's ideology. Indeed, the cynic would certainly see Begin's call at the Third World Convention of Beitar in 1938 to usher in a new period of military Zionism, and even more pointedly, David Ben-Gurion's call for fighting Zionism only 2 months later as nothing more than opportunistic repackagings of Achmer's concept of revolutionary Zionism from 10 years earlier. The historian Eric Hobsbawm cites the relevance of, and I quote, "the date when the first adult generation of children of the revolution emerge on the public scene, those whose education and careers belong entirely to the new era." The original children of Achmer's revolution came of age with the eventual election of Begin as prime minister in 1977. Yet by the time of Begin's speech, 40 years before, Achamer's political revolution had been gaining ground for almost a decade. And certainly Avram Stern, the leader of the Stern Gang, one of Brit Iberianim's sympathizers, likewise fell under his influential spell, although perhaps more than that, more that of Achamer the man of action than Achamer the actual ideologue. And indeed, those looking for perfect ideological consistency in Achamer will be disappointed. This fact is perhaps not surprising, and we need only to take a cursory glance at Jabotinsky's or Ben-Gurion's or indeed a myriad of public figures' respective oeuvres to realize that Achamer is certainly not alone in this respect. He once described himself as an ancient pessimist who sometimes walked westward, sometimes eastward, taking no notice of the opinion of the crowd, data kahal, being interested only in sharing his own sometimes idiosyncratic Zionist morality. Thus, for example, he could accept Vladimir Lenin as a revolutionary, but not Leninism as a doctrine, and for a time at least, the anti-Marxist kernel of Nazism while rejecting its anti-Semitic shell. And in spite of the fact that he distanced himself from even Italian fascism once its racial laws were introduced in 1938, Achamer could, in 1953, blame part of the failure of Brit Iberianim on the fact that they had been unsuccessful in adopting a fascist modus operandi. Quite an amazing pamphlet to read. It is an astonishing claim, to say the least, but one which nonetheless points to the fact that Achamer drew a clear, if flawed, distinction between Italian fascism and Nazism. Likewise, he could use Spenglerian theory to explain away any sort of universal aspect to Judaism, but could just as easily ignore the universalist message in much of Jewish prophetic writing, especially Jeremiah. And not least, he could be at once a revolutionary and a counter-revolutionary, and this is kind of going back to one of my chapters, but I would say in the final analysis, I would say that Achamer's counter-revolution took the form of a de facto political insurrectionary revolution, one which opposed not only the very real British mandatory government, but also the more conceptual social revolution that was embodied in the certainly Labour left Zionist project. I talked a little bit about before the comparison I did between Chaim Lazarov's doctoral dissertation and Achamer's doctoral dissertation, and I would say it did lead to a couple of interesting conclusions. Perhaps owing to each man's bourgeois intellectual upbringing, I would say both Lazarov and Achamer had more or less formulated their particular ideological positions already by the end of their doctoral studies. In Achamer's case, practically every one of his future ideological cornerstones—the power of youth. I'll just list them for you. The preference of men of action over word, the concept of active heroism, the importance of drawing upon a rich historical past, the acceptance of violence, indeed the readiness for self-sacrifice in the service of the national cause, the rejection of Marxism, Bolshevism, socialism, and liberalism, and not least, a preoccupation with revolution and the messianic element that was implicit in all of this, is addressed already in his dissertation on Spengler in 1924. This fact is as surprising in its revelation, or it was at the time, as it is frustrating in the recognition inherent therein that the lack of scholarly engagement with Achamer's student work has allowed this key observation in his ideological development to be overlooked until now. And the further fact that Achamer was, as I quote in an earlier chapter, already by 1933 enamored with Mussolini and fascism, in 1923, excuse me, already with Mussolini and fascism, in a less than superficial way, led me to the conclusion that Achamer's complete ideological path was set already at the time of his emigration to Palestine in 1924. A conclusion as unexpected at the time for me, as it was critical to our understanding of his ideological development. Achamer would return time and again to these various ideological markers and would certainly develop and refine his position on all of them, but rarely would he introduce any serious new themes into his ideological admixture, during the period under discussion, I would say, throughout his whole life. His practical path, however, would require almost 10 years to catch up. Thus, in no small way, and this is, I would say, my most interesting discovery, or, you know, through this whole research project, all roads lead to Spengler. For whatever reason, and like many of his contemporaries, Achamer became enamored with the decline of the West and Spenglerian theory, in spite of the exceptions that he takes with Spengler's conceptions of Russia and Jewish history. Achamer remained ideologically, intellectually, and methodologically loyal to Spengler on some level throughout his life. Spengler provided an intellectual fascination and methodological framework that enabled Achamer's continued ideological growth. The fact that Spenglerian ideology was so easily misappropriated by fascism's most extreme and calamitous incarnation, Hitler's National Socialists, points to just how thick an ideological quagmire Spengler himself had wandered into. The Austrian satirist Karl Kraus called the Nazis the Untergangster des Abendlandes, or something. If you get German, it's a great joke. Anyway, likewise Achmeier. His initial inability to see past his love for fascist ideology, which culminated in his appeal, kind of rather perverse appeal, in print, to learn from the success of Nazism, underscores the danger of such blind faith. If the years 1924 to 1934 saw Achmeier's practical path catch up with his ideological path, the 10 years previous, 1914 to 1924, saw events unfold that would steer Achmeier's ideological path in primis. First, his time at the Herzliya Gymnasium from 1912 to 1914 strengthened Achmeier's love for the land and further reinforced his already strong Zionist leanings. Similarly, and second, the outbreak of war that prevented his immediate return to Palestine instilled in Achmeier an even deeper longing and nostalgia for the land to which he could not return. Third, the Bolshevik Revolution simultaneously reinforced both his Zionist and anti-Marxist leanings, as did the death of his brother that was the result of that revolution. It nonetheless also planted in Achmeier the idea of the utility of revolution and perhaps even the question of the permissibility of killing. To aid that goal. And both events numbed Achmeier to an existential alltag of violence, bloodshed, and death. Finally, his stint at university and his introduction to Spengler, gave Achmeier both the intellectual clout that he needed to become a member of the bourgeois intelligentsia and the methodological tools to develop further as such. In short, Zion nourished his soul. War, revolution, and his brother's death informed his body, heart, and psyche, and Spengler his brain. The rest, as it were, are details. There are two broad underlying theses in the book. One has to do with the proverbial throwing of the baby out with the bathwater, or perhaps better put, the danger of taking an all-too-easy, dismissively au courant methodological approach. The fact that Spengler is now considered rather outmoded has, in the past, perhaps, prevented a deeper engagement with both Spenglerian theory and its profound and lasting influence on Achmeier. I believe that I demonstrated that the danger that such a methodological shortcut may pose. Furthermore, Achmeier's own claim that he was a bona fide fascist has perhaps led to a scholarly complacency that has until now taken Achmeier's claim at face value. Thus, Achmeier's true importance as a revolutionary figure has been overshadowed by a superficially raised arm towards the unquestioned acceptance of Achmeier as a mere fascist. I would like to think that the book has provided a more sophisticated analysis of his embrace of both phenomena. And finally, Zionist historiography has, until now, and with few exceptions, been dismissive of the historical role that Achmeier himself played. This study, I think, with its focus on ideology, has not only confirmed, in my opinion, that Achmeier was a key figure in the development of the ideology of revisionist Zionism and its legacy, but also demonstrated how and why that's the case. The second underlying thesis is tied to the first and concerns the writing of what I would say difficult history. Even today, more than 50 years after his death, Achmeier's name and legacy are still able to provoke polarized reactions and heated debate. Nonetheless, I tried very hard to approach the study with neither a preconceived outcome nor a political agenda. I wasn't related to anybody. It just all kind of happened. Of course, there's always limitations, and we decide what to put in, not what to put in. But I think I would like to say there is no position before going in, and certainly even no position now, if I'm honest. Indeed, there's a third underlying thesis in the study, although I'm hesitant to kind of name it as such, if only because of my incapacity for doing any more than hinting at its presence. But its presence was all pervading for me. And the inability to introduce empirically the psychological element into this study represents at once the major weakness in, and also very likely the key to, a completely comprehensive understanding of Achmeier's ideological and practical development. Right? Thus, at the end of a study that has offered a more ideologically focused intellectual biography of Abba Achmeier during the years when he was most politically active, I likewise admit my frustration at being unable to more successfully delineate the human aspect that most certainly also informed Achmeier's ideology and practice during that time. but it's there. Whether in Achmer's longing for Zion, or the heartbreak and the death of his brother, or indeed the loss of his first wife, or temporary loss of his daughter, who was raised by his sister because he was always in jail, and she was raised believing that he was in fact her uncle, and found out only through reading a hidden letter when she was 15 or 16 that he was in fact her father. Achmer was not a journalist and political activist who happened to have a few close relationships, but rather a brother, a husband, a father, who happened to be a notorious journalist and political activist. And the fact that Achmer's love for Zion was perhaps as strong as his love for those close to him does not nonetheless mitigate the latter observation. And the fact that the consequences of his political activism in the service of Zionism would come to overshadow his reputation, historical legacy, and reception should not mitigate the observation that Abba Achmer occupied an integral ideological position in the history of the Zionist right. Thank you. Mm-hmm.